Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. As always, I'm so glad you could join me as we look through the boxes and binders and the top loaders and the stacks of classic and not so classic cardboard in your collection. Of course, talking about some baseball cards from the 1980s this week. We've got a couple of sets from the 1980s that we're going to be talking about, and it's two completely different sets from two completely different years brought together under the guise of being a super value, or as I like to call it, forced fun. Now, you have been the unwilling participant of forced fun. You may not notice it. You may not recognize it. But it has happened to you. And you may be going, Matt, what are you talking about, forced fun? Well, like I said, you've been there before. Forced fun typically happens around either a family event or a workplace event. And I was racking my brain trying to think if I had a family forced fun event, and I don't recall any. I'm sure there was one, but I just don't remember it right at the moment. But family forced fun is something that is typically built around a family tradition that's often, you know, attached to a holiday. You know, maybe it's Christmas or New Year's or Thanksgiving or somebody's birthday or anniversary or something like that. But typically it's something like you go to Perkins every day after Thanksgiving because their pies are on sale, and it's something that your dad used to do, and it's something that his dad used to do. So even though it's nothing that is really worth your time or all that entertaining, your family still does it because that's how it's always been done. All right, kids, let's go jump in the station wagon and go to Perkins. It's the day after Thanksgiving. But Dad, it's raining. It's 46 degrees, and I just don't want to. Come on, get in the car. This is what we always do. We're going to eat pie. Dad, I don't want any pie. You know, I'm still kind of stuffed from Thanksgiving. Get in the freaking car. Go! You know, forced fun. And then you're in the booth at Perkins, and you're going, yay, I'm having fun with some blueberry pie, and I really don't want any of my life. It's just so terrible. So that's family forced fun. Like I said, I couldn't think of any personal family forced fun events. I'm sure if I really thought about it, I could find one. But the other one, I've got examples of that, the workplace forced fun. And this isn't necessarily talking about my current employer, but, you know, I've had several jobs, several paths in my career over the last 20 or so years. And I know of how employee forced fun happens. Typically once or twice a year, your human resources department sends out a survey, and it's just to, you know, get the internal temperature. How's everyone feeling? How's the workplace environment going? Because, you know, the HR department can't go from office to office and conduct in-depth interviews to see how you're doing. They got a lot going on. So they, you know, they send out those 50 question, quote unquote, anonymous surveys to the employees. And, you know, how are you feeling? What do you think of your coworkers? Are you stressed out? Et cetera, et cetera. And I'm sure, you know, a lot of times they get something that is kind of middle of the road. You know, some people are a little unhappy, but most of all, they do enjoy being employed and doing something that they like doing, so it's okay. But every now and then, you get that large collection of surveys that comes back, and the whole score of the office is not good. You know, employee morale is low. People are overworked, they're underpaid, they're underappreciated. Maybe they like what they're doing, but they're not liking it as much as they should because they don't have the resources. Maybe they're starting to feel like their career's hitting a rut. You know, they're just kind of spinning the wheels and just waiting for, you know, an advancement opportunity, and they're just kind of down and glum. Well, if you get enough people reporting that, then the collective report is, oh, morale is low, and people aren't as productive, and they're not as happy. And the HR department goes back to, you know, the senior management and leadership or ownership, you know, depending on how the company is structured. And they go, hey, we got a problem. Employee morale is low and we've got some really unhappy people. And, you know, such and such percent say they're actually out looking for better opportunities somewhere. What do we do? And the people who get paid six-figure salaries, who have impressive resumes of leadership and who rub elbows with all sorts of dignitaries in the business world and the local government, et cetera, through their years of experience and through their knowledge and through their incredible wisdom, they go, take them out to lunch. So then you have the employee forced fun, where HR sends out the email that says, all right, we're all having a big employee lunch. Everybody leave the office. We're going to Dave and Buster's. It's Tuesday, 11 a.m., but we're going to Dave and Buster's. Come along. So you just kind of go, okay. And, you know, you go to the Dave and Buster's or whatever it is, and you show up and they go, hey, we've got lunch for you. You know, it's warmed over chicken tenders from the night before. Here's your drink coupons. Sorry, no alcohol. We can't do that while we're, you know, on the clock. So it's, you know, a flat Sierra Mist for you. Hey, here's a game card. Go have fun. You can't, you know, redeem your game card for tickets and at least bring your kids something, you know, home from the employee forced fun at Dave and Buster's. And, you know, at the end of the day, as you're munching on this, you know, rock hard warmed over chicken strip and you're, you know, enjoying your flat Sierra Mist and you've got a game card with 500 points on it, but you can't exchange it for the, you know, little balsa wood airplanes for your kids to toss around the living room. You just kind of go, you know, this really wasn't fun. And I actually wish I was back in the office because now I've wasted 2 hours and I'm getting indigestion from these god-awful chicken tenders. So, you know, that's the employee forced fun. And we've been through that at some point in our lives. And the reason why I tell you these long and rambling stories about forced fun is this week's show is all about a forced fun experience in the world of baseball cards. There are packages of cards called Fun Packs. Now, that was actually the trademark name from Topps, as specifically in the 1970s. That's when you saw most of them. Although the Fun Pack actually dates back to the 1960s. And it all has to deal with clearing out inventory. And we've talked about this before. It was actually part of our last show about how Topps utilized their bubblegum empire to help move product out with the Super Pack in the late 70s and early 80s, where they basically just combined a cello pack with a three-piece pack of gum, marked up the price 10 cents, and moved more baseball cards out. It was an economic necessity. It was a promotional stroke of genius, which Topps, for whatever reason, never followed up on. So the whole idea of packaging cards with something to move inventory out is nothing new. And the Topps Fun Packs were actually fun in the sense that you got, I think, like 20 packs in a plastic bag. And it was basically just a grab bag. All right, we'll take two baseball, two football, two basketball, two hockey packs. Okay, what are the other 12? Well, let's see. We'll do four Dukes of Hazzard card packs. We'll do four Star Wars card packs. All right, four more Charlie's Angels star packs. So you know, all these other, you know, baseball card, or not baseball cards, but the entertainment cards that Topps would produce at the time, they would just mix in these other non-sports packs, and you would buy the, you know, the bag for like $2 or $3, whatever it was. Well, in the name of trying to have fun, forcing fun upon us, Donruss did the exact same thing in the 1980s, and for the exact same reasons. They needed to clear out a lot of inventory. But they won up Topps in that not only did Donruss clear out inventory at a super low price, but they repackaged their old baseball cards And when I say repackaged, I'm talking even worse than warmed over chicken tenders at the Dave and Buster's at your forced fun event at work. Imagine if a plateful of chicken tenders goes back to the Dave and Buster's kitchen, but it's not like a buffet plate worth. No, it's actually like a table serving plate. You know, it's a plate that's got dipping sauce and some, half-chewed French fries on it. And the guy back in the kitchen goes, oh, wait, these chicken tenders haven't been touched. Here, let's put these over here. We can use them tomorrow. And then they take the chicken tenders and they cut them up and they put them into a bowl of slightly green brown lettuce, throw a little cup of honey mustard in there, and they say, here's our new Dave and Buster's Fresh Garden Salad. And they resell it to you. That is what Donruss did with baseball cards in the fun pack. Of course, they couldn't call it a fun pack. It was the Super Value Pack. It was one that I procured from eBay. And as I will tell you in great detail, the Donruss Super Value Pack, which as it would turn out was released in 1985, this particular one, was not super, and it was only a value in the thinnest of definitions of value. And I'll leave it at that. It was definitely forced fun. I guess you could call it forced super value. Hey, this is really super, isn't it? It's a value. You saved pennies on this, you dope. So we'll discuss the 1985 Donruss Super Value bag of goodies in just a little bit. First, some housekeeping. I will save you the ignominy of going through crappy baseball cards from the mid-1980s Donruss stash in our next program, which will be 2 weeks from today. That will be Friday, August the 2nd. And we will post our show then at noon Eastern via Audio Boom. Also, all of the various channels that feed off of the Audio Boom RSS feed, including iTunes, iHeartRadio, TuneIn, Stitcher, Blueberry, Google Play, Spotify. I mean, we're everywhere. So make sure you mark your calendar for the program on August the 2nd, as we will be joined by Andy from Sports Card Backs. And Andy's been a longtime listener of this podcast. We've engaged in some very interesting conversations over the years via Twitter. And Andy and his broadcast partner, Mark, had me on their podcast a couple weeks ago, Baseball Beyond Batting Average. If you want to follow them on Twitter, it's BBBA_podcast. And while the podcast is normally a very intense stats-driven discussion between the two, they are doing a little bit of summer programming. In the talk radio world, we call it the week after the All-Star game when there's nothing to talk about. You touch up on the sports Mount Rushmores. But this was far more entertaining than your typical local sports talk station mailing it in the Wednesday after the All-Star game. We were talking about the Mount Rushmores of the American League East teams, and the guys are doing a division-by-division Mount Rushmore dissection. I believe their latest show is the American League Central. So as a former employee of the Tampa Bay Rays, I don't think I've ever fully gotten into that story. I'll do that in a little bit. But as, you know, former part-time employee of the Devil Rays / Rays, and as a longtime Rays fan, and as you know, a former fan of the Toronto Blue Jays, I've got a little bit of inside knowledge about the American League and you know, certainly offered up my Mount Rushmores. And it was a very fun discussion. It was very long-winded because, as you know, I can't shut up. I tend to talk and talk, which is good when you're, you know, trying to do a four-hour sports talk show. But when you take your 60-minute podcast and stretch it out to 80, It's totally my fault. So thanks to Andy and Mark for having me on their podcast. Again, Baseball Beyond Batting Average. You can follow them and find the link to our podcast at BBBA_podcast on Twitter. It's also available on iTunes. And like I said, we had a lot of fun talking about the American League East Mount Rushmores. Now, Andy will be joining us to talk about sports card backs. A lot of his focus is on the baseball card backs, and we will discuss why he is more interested in baseball card backs than baseball card fronts. And he and I have actually had a lot of back and forth about the backs of baseball cards. He loathes the early Bowman cards, and I love them. So I'm sure we'll clash about that. And, you know, talk about some of his favorite sports card backs. And, you know, the backs of baseball cards are fascinating, especially when you go back to the 1950s and 60s and even the 70s. You know, everything kind of got conservative in the 80s with the competition. Nobody really wanted to think outside the box. Actually, I take that back. You know, Fleer had some pretty ingenious things that happened on the backs of their cards in the 80s, first with the black and white photographs, and then eventually the, you know, the interesting advanced stats that they would start including, like, you know, hot zones and pre-All-Star break and post-All-Star break performance. So, you know, the backs of cards are very interesting, and it goes back to some of the cartoons that Topps included, some of the rather unique facts about players. You know, sometimes, you know, it's hard finding information on 792 baseball players. So sometimes Topps had to dig really deep and, you know, come up with some gem like, you know, Mike is a collector of ice popsicle sticks. You know, just some weird off the wall stuff. So we'll be discussing that with Andy. And I think just to tie in baseball card backs, I do have a few packs of cards from the early to mid 80s that are just kind of sitting in my closet that I purchased for previous shows, and I just haven't opened them yet. So perhaps I'll open up one or two of those packs, and we'll look at the backs more than the fronts. And of course, get you prepared for that show. Now, Wax Ecstatic does come your way every other week, every other Friday at noon Eastern, as I mentioned. And you can listen to our shows on demand via Audio Boom. And again, all those other platforms I mentioned, the whole archive is up there. And we certainly encourage you to support the show, not only listening to it, but promoting it for us. Share our Twitter timeline at Wax and Gum Stains. It's open 24/7. We offer up all sorts of fun talk, not only promoting our show and telling you, you know, where you can watch video links of pack openings and where you can listen to our show, but also, you know, just talk about the industry, talk about baseball cards, talk about the sport, talk about the big score you made at maybe the national show. If you're going to that, go ahead and just share your comments at any time. As we've got the baseball card community chatting away there again at Wax and Gum Stains. And what makes Wax Ecstatic possible is the occasional cash donation from you, the listener. It is a free podcast, and it's not free to make. There are some costs, mostly hosting the program on Audio Boom and the various channels. There's a static fee to that, but also procuring the packs that we do open and we share with you. It does take a few bucks, and I am not rolling around a dough, so I appreciate any contributions that you can make. And you can make a cash donation via our PayPal site. That's paypal.me/waxecstatic. And as always, 100% of your donations, whether it's $2 or $20 or somewhere in between or slightly more than that, it goes right back into the program. Either the maintenance of the program, as in hosting the new shows and the archive at Audio Boom and the various channels that latch on to the RSS feed, or the purchase of the packs, the boxes, the single cards, you name it, that we're able to share and discuss on this show. And a reminder, any excess products, so for example, certainly some of the cards from our Super Value Pack, We'll go into the big old donation box of cards that we assemble every few months and send off to one of two groups. Commons for Kids, they are up in line next. I got a hunch probably by the end of summer they'll be getting a shipment of cards from this program. And Commons for Kids, as the name implies, they basically take your unwanted common cards and they will sort them and they will donate them to kids through various charities and gifts, which is awesome. And our other group that we send the package to every few months is Kidority Cards, where you can make a small purchase, a monthly subscription to your child's favorite baseball team and other sports too. But, you know, we're focusing mostly on baseball here. But let's say your child is a big fan of the Dodgers. Well, you get that monthly subscription and every month Kidority Cards will send you a pack of cards that have been hand-selected. It's a mixture of old cards and new cards, a mixture of different players, and your child is exposed to different generations of players from his or her favorite team. And both of these operations, Kidority Cards and Commons for Kids, help continue to not only lighten the load in your baseball card collection, but also share baseball cards with kids, keep kids connected to the hobby, to the sport, and keep them out of trouble, which is certainly something that we all need to collectively do. And doing it through baseball cards is a great way to do it. So every penny that you donate to our cause here at Wax Ecstatic not only keeps you entertained with the show, but also entertains kids who may not have the extra nickels and dimes in their pockets to get those baseball cards. So again, paypal.me/waxecstatic. We appreciate all donations that have come in over the past couple of years, and we certainly appreciate your next donation as you find it in your heart and a little bit in your wallet to donate to the program. Now, I wanted to, you know, I kind of got sidetracked by the idea of not really sharing my whole Devil Rays story. And perhaps I did back, I want to say it was like episode 65 or something like that. I did an episode on team sets. And through my own personal collection, I have a team set of 2002 Tampa Bay Devil Rays cards. And they were a promotional giveaway. It was sponsored by Tropicana, which is still a major sponsor of the Rays. And as luck would have it, I just happened to be at the game where they were handing these out. I was not looking for these. I just had a couple tickets to a game, showed up. They gave me a pack of cards. Oh, that's nice. I put them away. And it was a lot of fun 2 or 3 years ago going through this old team set and being reminded of how incredibly terrible the 2002 Tampa Bay Devil Rays were. In fact, I think statistically they are still the worst team in franchise history. And as I went through the cards and recalled some of the players and, you know, covering the team for a local radio station at the time, I remember, you know, seeing these guys and talking to them and getting to know them a little better. It brought back a lot of great memories. And you know, that was kind of my introduction to working with the Devil Rays, you know, back in the early 2000s as I was trying to establish myself here in the Tampa Bay media area. And as fate would have it, you know, I was also doing some similar work with the Lightning, my current employer, the NHL team. And during the Lightning's 2004 Stanley Cup run, they were pulling out all the stops, and basically anyone involved in their game entertainment department. These are the people that, you know, put on the funny videos on the scoreboard, the people who control the rock music that plays during stoppages and play, you know, the people who are in charge of the, you know, the energy team and the cheerleaders and all that. Well, during the Stanley Cup run in 2004, the Lightning basically told all of these employees, and they're all part-time seasonal employees, they said, you need to be here for every game. We've got to have our A-list employee group here, so whatever's on your calendar, scratch it. You've got to be here for every game during this run. Well, as is the case in pretty much every city that has more than one professional sports team, the people who do this part-time game day work for one team typically do it for other teams in the area. And because hockey and baseball seasons typically don't overlap that much, there's a little bit in October, and there's a little bit in April, depending on, you know, if a hockey team is in a playoff situation. But for the most part, they kind of run concurrently, you know. So the Lightning are going on the Stanley Cup championship run. The Devil Rays at the time were about to pop the champagne on having won 70 games in the 2004 season. And that's true. They actually popped champagne in Detroit when they got win number 70 on the last game of the season. Oh, boy, those were the days. And, you know, obviously it was not that difficult of a decision if you were straddling the fence between working Lightning games and working Devil Ray games. Obviously, you worked the Lightning playoff games. You wouldn't, you know, who cares about a, you know, a 1 o'clock start in the middle of May between the Devil Rays and the Twins at Tropicana Field. So I had a person who was in charge of the game entertainment operations at the Devil Rays, a guy named John Franzone, who ironically now works for the Lightning. I actually helped him get his job there. John reaches out to me and he says, you know, hey, you know, I was asking for some, you know, information on people who could play music and sound effects during the baseball game when we have these conflicts with the hockey games, and somebody brought your name up because you do this at a radio station. So long story short, I started filling in for the music guy, a gentleman named Billy Heald, who, you know, would play the walk-up music, and, you know, if a foul ball goes into the stands, you'd push that button that goes, doink, and people laugh at it. So, you know, that's some of the work that I started doing, just kind of on this part-time, as-needed fill-in basis during the 2004 Cup run. And then, as time would go on, I would provide, you know, this group, they called it Rays Vision. I would provide them with some factoids about players that they would type into the scoreboard. So, you know, I was the guy doing the research so that on the big, you know, Daktronic scoreboard, it would say, you know, Evan Longoria collects ice popsicle sticks. I don't think he did, but I'm just using that for an example. But also, as it would turn out, it was during the 2007 season, and I was still kind of a part-time contract with the Lightning, even though that was becoming more of a full-time job for me. There was somebody at the Devil Rays who left to do some work at the University of Central Florida, and they needed somebody mid-season to come in and do some scoreboard operations. So I would go in there and I would get paid $20 an hour to just sit behind a computer. And if, you know, Evan Longoria hit a base hit to right field, actually Longo wasn't on the team, not in Tampa Bay then. Okay. If Travis Lee, you know, had a base hit, or Ben Zobrist, you know, had a base hit to left field, I would just take a computer mouse and click to left field, and it would automatically update all the stats. So all those numbers that you see pop up on a scoreboard, that's basically what I did. And I'd sometimes run the balls and strikes count during games. And I did this up until 2008 or 2009. And, you know, it was a lot of fun. I got paid ridiculously good money for clicking mouses and, you know, pushing buttons for every time the umpire said strike. So, you know, that was my experience with the Devil Rays, and it was a lot of fun, even though the majority of the games that I did fell between 2004 and 2007, and the Devil Rays did not do a whole lot of winning during that time. But it was quite the experience to see the inner workings of the event operations with the stadium, and you know, certainly helped me as my career grew with the Lightning as well. So that's just a little backstory there, and that's why you know, I can chuckle when I hear names like Travis Lee or Ty Wigington and other greats in Devil Rays history. That's also why I'm you know, thoroughly impressed with Edwin Jackson, the fact that he's still pitching in the major leagues. You know, the former outfielder turned pitcher who, while in Tampa Bay, was getting forced into a starting role and he didn't want it. And, you know, it turned out to prolong his career. I mean, that was well, that was 15 years ago, that the Devil Rays were, you know, taking this guy who, like I said, was 5 years prior an outfielder prospect, and they're trying to move him from the bullpen to the starting rotation, and it certainly prolonged his career. And I think he's on Major League team number 84 now. But that was a lot of fun. So it's kind of funny, you know, people hear, you know, former employee of the Rays, and you think I did some kind of radio broadcasting or something. It's no, I was clicking a mouse or doing some research or pushing the button that goes doink when a foul ball ends up in the stands. So just thought I'd share that with you. I thought that was a lot of fun back then. Now, that was pure fun. That was true fun. That was fun that brings a smile to my face. What was not fun was the super value pack that Donruss assembled back in 1985. And we had a video link go out on Wax and Gum Stains yesterday, linking you to the package opening. And you can tell I am not amused. This is probably the lowest I felt opening a pack of cards since the 85 top seller that I opened up that somehow managed to jam five dreaded manager cards into one pack. But, you know, that's just pure luck. It's just how the circulation of cards ended up in that one pack. This, however, this was the reheated, chopped up garden salad at Dave and Buster's package of fun that was forced down my throat. And, you know, I do have to take some of the blame here. I actually sought this out. You know, again, trying to come up with topics of conversation on this podcast. You know, sometimes you do circle back and touch on certain sets or certain issues that you've discussed before. So just trying to mix it up a little bit. You know, recently I've been on a unique packaging kind of run. So that's how I ended up with the Topps Super Pack a couple of weeks ago. Was just looking for something a little different, and I found it on eBay, and I bid it, and it was actually a pretty fun experience opening up a cello pack of cards from 1981 that didn't have gum stains, that weren't damaged by the super tight cello packing that Topps did in 81. By having chewing gum, even though it was 38 years old, was actually still chewable and actually had some flavor. I'm not sure what kind of chemical imbalance my body will experience after chewing on that gum for a couple of minutes. But, you know, that was kind of a neat thing. So I'm, again, cruising around eBay. I'm like, okay, I've always wanted to open up one of these fun packs. Well, the Topps fun packs from the 1970s I was talking about earlier, while they are unique, they're also a little pricey because you do have two packs of baseball cards and two packs of hockey cards. Well, not always baseball cards because the baseball cards used to sell. But, you know, hockey and football and basketball cards were a little harder for Topps to push out, which is why they ended up in these fun packs because, again, they're just trying to clear out inventory at the end of the year. So why not throw a whole bunch of packs into this grab bag and mark down the price a couple bucks? So, you know, those the fun packs are a little expensive these days because, you know, if you get a couple of Topps hockey packs from 1978, well, those normally sell for about 20 bucks a pop on the open market. Same thing with basketball and football cards back then. And it's not necessarily because there's a guaranteed star card in any of those cards, but it's a 40-year-old pack of cards. And those, you know, they attach a premium price to it. Likewise, cards featuring Star Wars or Dukes of Hazzard or Charlie's Angels or Jaws the movie, you know, it's a collector's item. These are, you know, unique TV shows or films from American history, and the fact that there's still unopened packs of cards, there's a value to them. There's a little bit of a scarcity to them. So the Topps fun packs, unless I get a boatload of donations through the PayPal site, paypal.me/waxecstatic. I'm probably not purchasing one of those just yet. I'm not quite in that income tax bracket. So as I'm cruising around looking for an affordable fun pack, I fall upon several people selling these Donruss Super Value Packs. And there were different incarnations of Donruss Super Packs, mostly from the early 80s. And as I was saying before, it was Donruss looking to clear out some inventory. Now, the sad story behind the Donruss Super Value Pack shows how sad of a situation Donruss was in the early 80s. As we've discussed before and as collectors are very well aware of, Donruss was a very late entry into the baseball card race in 1981. The battle to open up the baseball card world, to break the monopoly that Topps had, was a long battle between Topps and Fleer. You can say it technically goes back to the early 1960s, but really what opened the door started in 1974 with little court battles, and then in the summer of 1980, the doors got blown wide open when the court system actually determined, yeah, Topps has a monopoly, you have to open up things to competition. Well, Fleer was ready to go. And that's why if you look at the 1981 sets, even though Fleer was not the best one, it was certainly far better than Donruss. Donruss came in quite literally at the last minute. And in a matter of just a few weeks, they had to come up with a card design and they had to find photographs for, you know, 600 cards. And, the photographs weren't always good. The card stock was flimsy. The bubble gum was toxic. I say that loosely, figuratively, not literally, I think. We're still waiting for results to come back from the lab. But, the Donruss product was just an absolute mess in 1981. Gradually, it improved in 82 and 83. Not great, but better than 81. And starting in 1984, and definitely by 1985, Donruss had better photography, some sharp designs, some desirable cards, and it was starting to finally find its way throughout North America in wholesale distribution. And that was one of the big challenges for Donruss and Fleer in the early days, is Topps didn't just have a monopoly on the certain number of products that were out there. They controlled the whole operation. So they had the inside edge on wholesalers and retailers and creative marketing. And, you know, they knew everything inside and out, and Fleer and Donruss kind of stumbled into it. It took them a few years to figure it out. So also by 1985, as Donruss is starting to hit a groove here and put out some really good cards, they still have warehouses full of old packs. They've got old factory sets. They've got old wax packs. They've got just crates and crates and cases of all this stuff. Well, rather than just dump it in the water, you know, like Topps did in 1952, much to the chagrin of collectors these days, the people in Donruss thought, okay, we've got to find some way to get some money back from this. We can't just have this product sit in a warehouse somewhere. We've got to do something with it. So the Leaf Company, which had taken ownership of the Donruss product by 1985, they come up with a brilliant idea. They go, aha, remember those Topps fun packs in the 70s? Well, they were just clearing out inventory. They were just trying to get some pennies on the dollar return for this product. Let's do the exact same thing. So they not only took what was in the warehouse and just tossed it in a bag and lowered the price, they actually repackaged this stuff. So when you open up this big super value pack and you look on the front of the bag and it says $8.75 value, now just $1.99. All right, you can see we're talking pennies on the dollar here, where, you know, this is basically what, about 25% of the manufactured suggested retail price. So you can see the markup on these cards. Donruss will just practically give these away, but they do want a little return on the investment. And you look at this bag and you go, wow, there's 25 packs of cards. And you open it up and you realize, oh, yeah, there's 25 packs of cards, but 18 of these packs are of the Donruss Action All-Star set, and the other seven are these mysteriously rewrapped cards. So first you have the Action All-Star set, which is unique. You know, this was something that was very common in the card industry in the 80s. It was producing the big card, and that was very representative of life in America in the 80s, as we're digging ourselves out of the 70s and we're kind of stumbling early on in the decade, all of a sudden this patriotic pride comes around. We're not just America, we're bigger than you. We're better than you. Well, that shows up in baseball cards as well, as Topps and Donruss both had some kind of variation of big cards. And Donruss, trying to outbig Topps in the 80s, had the super cards. So these were these 3.5-inch by 5-inch practically postcards of players. These were just ginormous versions of baseball cards. So, you know, you get 18 of these packs that each have three cards in them, and the Lou Gehrig Diamond King puzzle pieces as well, which you saw in the 85 Donruss base set. And, you know, it's kind of a neat set, but, you know, I'm really not all that interested in it. I want what's inside these wax packs. So, sidebar, the 18 Action All-Star packs, which do feature some star cards, I'm not opening those up. I'm just going to put them up for bid. So if you DM me at Wax and Gum Stains, make me an offer. I've got a price in mind. Let me just put it this way. I just want to move them out cheaply. Okay. I've got a price in mind. DM me how much you would pay for 18 of these packs. We'll throw in a dollar to cover the shipping, and we'll make ourselves a deal here. And I'll post this up on Wax and Gum Stains as well. Yeah, they are neat cards. To what I can gather, they are in mint condition with the exception of one. There's a Raleigh Fingers card that's on the top of one of the packs that is a little scuffed up. But the others, from what I can tell, are in mint condition. And hey, if you want a Don Mattingly or a Ryan Sandberg or a Tony Gwynn card from 1985, this is your chance to do it. It's a 60-card set. And, you know, if you want to add to your postcard size baseball card collection, they're there. So you can DM me if you're interested in doing that. So you've got these Action All-Star cards here. And then the other seven packs, you look at the packs, and they look like they're 81 Donruss. It's very similar artwork. But instead of the usual red pack, you've got red and blue and this kind of brownish-orange color. And you're looking at these and you're going, well, what's in here? So you open up the pack and you realize that these are 82 Donruss cards that are repackaged inside the wax pack. So, you know, your first thought is, ooh, it's 82. Maybe there's a Cal Ripken Jr. card, or maybe Ricky Henderson, or, I don't know, George Brett, Mike Schmidt, Robin Yount, Paul Molitor. You know, you're thinking of all these star players from the late 70s and early 80s. Hey, maybe they're in here. Maybe this really is a super value. No. I can already just imagine the people with the Leaf Company in the warehouse picking out all the Cal Ripken Jr. cards and the Robin Younts and the George Bretts and, you know, every other popular, decent player, and occasionally tossing in a decent card here and there. But honestly, it's all junk. It really is. And I encourage you to watch the video because it is kind of depressing. But, you know, the skinny of it is the seven packs of cards I get. Okay, what were some of the hits? Well, I did get one card, one of the kind of the duo star cards of Reggie Jackson and Dave Winfield. Okay, that's kind of cool. I got a Reggie Jackson card. All right, Reggie's a good one. There's an Ozzie Smith Diamond King card. Okay, that's cool. Got some Hall of Fame pitchers in there as well. You know, there's Ferguson Jenkins. There's Gaylord Perry. All right, that's cool. There's a neat star duo card of Mike Schmidt and Pete Rose. Got a couple of those. Okay, that's great. And that's about it. There wasn't a whole lot more. I have certainly doubled my 82 Donruss Commons collection, much to my delight. But what was more dumbfounding than the fact that there was a dearth of star cards or anything special was the overabundance of dreaded manager cards, also coach cards, but In particular, the recycling of several dud cards, and in fact, most notably, the Ed Lynch card. I not only got one, not two, but three Ed Lynch cards in these seven packs. Donruss somehow managed to package two Ed Lynch cards in one pack. So that's why I go back to that 85 Topps cello pack with the five dreaded manager cards. I somehow ended up with three Ed Lynch cards, a couple of semi-star kind of cool cards, and then just a whole bunch of crap. So it was not much of a value. It was certainly not super. And, you know, I had that feeling, you know, of the workplace forced fun where at the end you're chewing on that crunchy old chicken tender from the night before going, man, this sucks. And I don't have many regrets in my baseball card purchases, but this was one where I went, yeah, this wasn't good. And that's not the fault of the person I bought it from, reputable dealer. You know, the cards were actually in good shape, as in they weren't tossed around. The package was clearly unopened, 100% feedback on eBay. So I certainly do not fault the seller. It's just a really crappy aftermarket product that Leaf put out in 1985. But I will give them some credit. They found a way to move 105 old crappy cards out of their warehouse. And they also found a way to move, 18 times 3, that's 54 of their Action All-Star cards. Got those out of the warehouse too, because clearly their big moneymaker at the time was the Donruss base set in 1985 and not the Action All-Stars. So, you know, buyer beware in the sense of that's pretty much what you're going to get. It's not all that different from the pack chase boxes that you get now. I've bought those before just on a whim. You go to Walmart or Target and, you know, you pay $20 for the pack that has 20 packs in it, or the box that has 20 packs in it. And, you know, they tease you, you know, with the good packs on the outside. And then there's a whole lot of, you know, 91 Donruss and 90 Fleer inside. And then there's 10 packs of some mysterious Babe Ruth set that somebody was bored and decided to make in 1995. And it's really not worth anything. Same thing too, with if you go, and I've seen these in drugstores, you know, people have repackaged old baseball cards into these, you know, 100 card blister packs. And they tease you, you know, they'll put an 87 Topps Dwight Gooden on the top of the stack. But after that, you know, it's your Len Cicadas and your Rolando Rumas cards underneath. So, you know, those would actually be, and I've thought about it, I've thought about actually buying one of those blister packs and opening it up on the show just for the hell of it. But after opening up this absolute dud of a firecracker, I may just put that plan off for just a little while. Now, even though the value pack was not much of a value and certainly wasn't super, I did manage to pull four cards from it, as we typically do. We like to talk about some of the players that are in these packs. And there were some great baseball names. I also did get the San Diego Chicken card in here, which was kind of neat. So I'm going to talk about a couple of interesting names. I'm going to talk about the chicken. But first, we have to address the elephant in the room, and that is the Ed Lynch collection that is now growing by leaps and bounds. So let's talk a little bit about Ed Lynch, who, in all honesty, is actually a very underrated pitcher. Now, he's underrated mostly because he was not an overwhelmingly good pitcher, but also he was on some terrible teams in the 1980s, notably the New York Mets in the early 80s, and later in his career, the Chicago Cubs. Now, he was originally drafted by the Texas Rangers and got moved to the Mets in September of 1979. The Rangers were in a playoff race, so they picked up Willie Montanez and Mike Jorgensen, and Lynch went to the Mets. So Lynch was one of the few halfway decent pitchers out there. And like I said, he wasn't overwhelmingly good. If there's one thing that Ed Lynch did not possess, it was a hard fastball. This was a guy who was your prototypical junk pitcher. This was your Tim Wakefield without the knuckleball. This was the 1980s version of Casey Fossum. This is a guy who somehow managed to get the ball across the plate every 60 feet and 6 inches, and that was about it. And he managed to, you know, through craft work and through a decent selection of pitches, what he lacked in pitch quality, he certainly had in pitch quantity. He had a good changeup and a slider, slurve as well. And he was able to just kind of weave and bob his way through several years with the Mets. Now, the Mets, of course, doing a very long, lengthy, deep building, rebuilding project in the late 70s and early 80s. So while some of the young up-and-coming talents, such as a Dwight Gooden, and certainly the hitters as well as Darryl Strawberry would come up, through the system, and all the other guys who, you know, came in through free agency or trades in the 1980s. Well, Ed Lynch got pushed out the door. And what was tough for Lynch was he started the 86 season with the Mets, was dealing with a lot of injuries early on, though. And then, you know, he'd been completely pushed out of the rotation by all this talent that the Mets had. And he was traded to the Cubs for Dave Liddell and Dave Lenderman. And the good thing for Lynch here, even though he went from an eventual World Series champion team to a basement dwelling team in the Cubs, is that the Mets were very nice about sending him a World Series ring. In fact, he was the only member of the 86 Mets who was not with the team the entire season. You know, somebody who was traded by the Mets later on in the season to get a World Series ring. I think there were four other players who were in Lynch's situation. He's the only one that got that ring. And that was a very classy gesture by the Mets, because they acknowledged, okay, here's a guy who was the only decent pitcher on the staff for a few years, and at least we can get him something. Now, he would go back to school after his playing career ended in 1987, studied in law at the University of Miami, graduated in 1991, became part of the management in San Diego and Chicago, and of course became the general manager for the Cubs. And this was in the mid to late 90s. And he is best known for some not so favorable moves in his career. Would often throw in prospect players to, you know, in trades that turned out to really haunt the Cubs. I know Kyle Lowes was one of them. The other one was John Garland. You know, he was a top prospect for the Cubs, got thrown into a deal with the White Sox. And of course, Garland, part of the White Sox World Champion team in 2005. So Ed Lynch, you know, had a couple dud deals as a general manager with the Cubs, but was part of a Cubs resurgence in the mid-90s. He was a big fan of Kerry Wood. Helped, you know, the team get to the playoffs in the 97, and ultimately was forced out a few years later, just as the pressure of trying to replicate the success that the Cubs had, not in 97, I'm sorry, 98, but in trying to keep the Cubs in contention, the pressure got to him, and he eventually stepped aside as general manager. Was still a scout for the Cubs, later on was a professional scout in the Toronto Blue Jays organization, and was also recently the pitching coach for the Long Island Ducks. He was named the pitching coach prior to the season. However, just a few weeks ago, back on June 25th, he resigned his position officially in order to spend more time with his family. And that's normally pro sports legal talk for, yeah, I'm just not enjoying this job, so I'm going to leave. So there you go. There's Ed Lynch. And if you need an 82 Donruss Ed Lynch card, I'm your guy. Just let me know how many you need, and I will send them to you free of charge. Thank me later. It's my gift to you. Another great 80s name from these packs of cards here, Shooty Babbitt. Who doesn't love a little Shooty Babbitt? And to show you the strength of great names in baseball cards, Shooty Babbitt is the ultimate example, because as much as we remember the name Shooty Babbitt, and as much as we know, oh yeah, Shooty Babbitt, he was the guy with the Oakland A's, Shooty Babbitt had a major league career stretching a whopping 54 games. In fact, he only played just a few months with the A's. He didn't make it past the five-month mark in 1981. He was not a favorite of Billy Martin. And as we talked about in our last show, if you were a favorite of Billy Martin, you went wherever Billy went. Mickey Klutz was a great example. Klutz was part of the Yankees organization in the late 70s. And when Billy brings Billy Ball to Oakland in the early 80s, Mickey Klutz went with him. And that was very typical. Good old Billy Martin would latch on to some player somewhere. And every team he went to, there was a good chance that that player would get traded to the team that Billy Martin was the manager. Well, Shooty Babbitt, by the way, his birth name is Mac Babbitt. And Mac's not a very normal or common name. But Shooty, who was an Oakland native, by the way, and who was also a star, locally in the college ranks there. I think he went to Berkeley. He was a speedy player, half-decent hitter, but not very smart on the base paths, not very good defensively. And those were big negatives in the world of Billy Ball. You had to steal bases. You had to be defensively solid. And, the small ball way of Billy Ball did not play to Shooty Babbitt's strengths. Now, even though Babbitt started his major league career with a 7-game hitting streak, the second such longest in A's history, he would bat .256 in his 156 at-bats. He was caught stealing in 50% of his attempts. Like I said, defensively, he wasn't that sharp. And he didn't make it past the 1981 season with Billy Martin. And in fact, Martin famously said about Shooty Babbitt, "If you ever see Shooty Babbitt play second base for me again, I want you to shooty me." Now, Babbitt would eventually go on to be a scout for the Arizona Diamondbacks, also the New York Mets. And he has occasionally dabbled in broadcasting. Since 2008, he has been a color analyst for the Oakland A's and has, in fact, substituted as a color analyst for Ray Fosse several times in the year. Now, he has a son, Zach Babbitt, who was part of the L.A. Dodgers farm system for a few years. So Shooty Babbitt, again, showing the strength of how good a baseball name can carry somebody's memory. He really did not have a lengthy pro playing career, but because he is Shooty Babbitt, and we get to see him glowing in this green and gold from the early 1980s in this 82 Donruss pack, people tend to forget that he was loathed by Billy Martin and only had 54 games of major league experience. Now, somebody who had far more experience in the major leagues and is much beloved, mostly in Milwaukee, is the great Gorman Thomas here, featured in a Diamond King card. Gorman Thomas was the first amateur draft selection of the Seattle Pilots. You may not know that. Yeah, he was a first-round draft pick in 1969. He and Jim Slayton were the only draft picks of the Pilots to have notable major league careers. And Thomas would go on mostly as an outfielder, but especially factored into the Brewers' success as a designated hitter late in the 70s and into the early 80s. Now, that's something that would work against him later on in life. But he wasn't just a Diamond King in 1982. He was an all-star representative for the Brewers in 1981, twice led the American League in home runs in 1979 and 1982, served technically three tours of duty with the Brewers, his first stint mostly as an outfielder from 73 to 76, and then he got relegated to the minor leagues, became a DH specialist with the Brewers from 78 to 83, got traded to the Indians, didn't like his time in Cleveland, was very vocal about it, demanded a trade, Well, if you can't handle things in Cleveland, guess what? We're going to send you to Seattle. The Mariners, of course, were a train wreck in the mid-1980s, and that's where Thomas was for a couple of seasons. And then he was able to force a trade back to Milwaukee, where he was a DH in 1986, and he was able to wrap up his career there. Now, even though you look at Gorman Thomas and you kind of joke about his physical stature, you know, he was just a big hulking guy, got the nickname Stormin' Gorman Thomas. He was just this intimidating physical beast. He was an incredible athlete too. Growing up in the Charleston and Columbia, South Carolina area at Cardinal Newman High School in Columbia, he was part of the state champion basketball team in 1968. Later would attend James Island High School in his senior year, and in high school, he earned 14 letters in four sports: basketball, baseball, football, and track and field. Yeah, he was an all-round athlete. You couldn't ask for a better athlete. And of course, at the same time, too, he's being scouted by the major leagues and does get drafted by the Seattle Pilots, and eventually, you know, moves his way up as the Pilots move east to Milwaukee. And very much beloved in Milwaukee, he was a prototypical home run or strikeout guy. I bring up his name a lot when you talk about guys like Dave Kingman, or you talk about Pete Caviglia, you know, those guys that either hit the ball 420 feet or they would strike out, which is becoming kind of the norm now. You know, it used to be, you know, players hit for contact, and now it's power or nothing, as we've seen plenty of stories that have come out about how the home run is basically, it's either home run or strikeout now in baseball. But anyways, after his playing career, he picked up some interesting hobbies. He was an amateur golf player, involved or enjoyed hunting, also making duck decoys. He also got into the arts, picking up limited edition prints. He is now a representative, an ambassador for the Milwaukee Brewers. And his name is plastered on the Gorman's Grill at Miller Park. He was also elected to the Wisconsin Athletic Hall of Fame in 2003 and is also part of the Miller Park Walk of Fame as well. And I joke about Gorman Thomas because it wasn't just his physical stature, but he just kind of had this lumberjack look to him. You know, he had the beard, he had the long hair. And Gorman Thomas, I joke, looks like the Yeti from Harry and the Hendersons. And considering he did play in Seattle in the mid-80s, and Harry and the Hendersons came out in 1987, I believe, I don't know if there is any photographic evidence of Bigfoot and Gorman Thomas together in the same room in Seattle in that same time. Last but not least, the San Diego Chicken. This was kind of a neat card that I did pull from the packs here. And it goes to show how popular the San Diego Chicken was by 1982. He was a worldwide phenomenon by then. But the origins of the San Diego Chicken are quite innocent. And for me, they're very special because it all starts as just a dumb radio promotion. In San Diego, starting in 1974, there was a radio station called KGB. It was started on AM, but they were starting to branch out in FM as well, as a lot of stations were in the 1970s. And there was a pretty good radio battle going on in San Diego in the mid-1970s. Not quite the Anchorman battles, where we have street battles of TV stations in San Diego around the same time with Ron Burgundy and crew. But no, there was a playful battle between KGB, also KFMB, and the mighty 690 Extra, which had a booming signal that got into Los Angeles. So sometimes you had some Los Angeles stations like KHJ would bleed into San Diego. So, you know, you had a pretty fun competitive atmosphere. Well, thinking back to early mid-70s, as FM radio was starting to take the lead in some markets, remember who was at these radio stations. A lot of the times it was the wild children of the 1960s. Well, as they're experimenting with stereo albums and album-oriented rock in the early 70s, and you could do that a lot better with the FM signal, the stereo signal, You basically have these wild children of the 60s who become the mellow, cool kids of the 70s, and they're the ones in charge of the radio stations. Well, somebody at KGB decided we need to do something that sets us apart from KFMB and Extra and all these Los Angeles stations that kind of invade the market. So they decided they needed to come up with a mascot. Well, what better mascot for a radio station than a big yellow chicken? And that's what they got. They got this cheap chicken costume, and the promotions staff went to the San Diego State student radio station, and sitting in the lobby of the radio station, along with several other employees or students, I should say, is one Ted Gianulis. Now, Gianulis, in an interview, very interesting interview on another San Diego station. In fact, it was, I believe, KFMB. It was KFMB. There's a show called It's Your Money and Your Life. A few years ago, they talked to Gianulis, and he says it was just, you could say it's fate. You know, he just decided right before spring break, well, I'm just going to go swing by the student radio station, see what's going on. Well, as fate would have it, it was the exact same time that this rep from KGB shows up. And he says, hey, we're doing this promotion at the San Diego Zoo, and I need one of you guys to dress up as a chicken and hand out Easter eggs. And, you know, we'll pay you $2 an hour. Now, he's going to the student radio station because nobody at KGB wants to lower themselves to, you know, dressing up as a chicken in this smelly mascot costume and handing out chocolate Easter eggs at the zoo. So Gianulis jumps at it. He's like, absolutely, I'll do it, because he sees the opportunity in that, hey, I'm working for a real radio station. So sure enough, he does this promotion at the San Diego Zoo for a week. And, you know, there's not a whole lot to it. And when it's all done, he decides to kind of keep the whole gig going. So he talks to the radio station about, hey, can I continue to, you know, dress up as the chicken and do promotional events for you? And the station's like, yeah, sure, okay. So Gianulis, who is also a fan of the Padres, his family had season tickets to the Padres, he thinks, you know, I could probably get into Padres games for free by dressing up as the chicken and just kind of mingling with fans. Well, remember where the Padres were as the 1974 season started. They almost were in Washington, D.C. But as we've discussed in our past 74 Tops episodes, Ray Kroc comes in at the last minute in the winter of 1974, saves the Padres, basically buys them on the cheap, inherits a ton of debt, but also signs stadium extensions with the city of San Diego and Jack Murphy Stadium, and saves the Padres. And the Padres were a terrible team. Ray Kroc was an incendiary personality, and people were not exactly flocking to the Murph in droves to watch the Padres. So, again, as fate would have it, this just goofy idea of Gianulis to show up at Padres games in a chicken outfit works for everybody. He calls the Padres, and the Padres go, yeah, we'll let you do this, but you have to give us a free plug on KGB. So the Padres are seeing it as free marketing on a big radio signal. And the radio station, as it would turn out, you know, at opening day, pictures of Gianulis just walking around the stands in a chicken costume, you know, they get printed up in the local paper. Well, KGB's thrilled because they're getting free marketing, free exposure from this. Gianulis is thrilled because he's working for a real radio station, getting to watch his favorite baseball team for free. And as time went on, you know, what started as just Gianulis getting into the stadium for free and just kind of shaking hands with fans and goofing off, well, it turns into stunts in the stands, and then it turns into stunts on the field. And by the end of the 70s, the San Diego Chicken, as it would later be known, as, you know, he had a little falling out between KGB and his burgeoning enterprise here. Well, you know, he would basically take over the rights to the chicken. He had to redesign the costume. But he became not the first mascot in sports history. In fact, mascots go back to the early 20th century. but he would become one of the first nationally recognized, marketable celebrity mascots in sports. He would become an American icon in that goofy decade that was the 1970s. And you can also lay the blame of some of the worst mascots at Gene Ulis' feet, because he and the Padres are having so much success with this that other teams decide, well, we need a mascot too. So, you know, the Crazy Crab in San Francisco. Let's see, Cleveland had a pretty ugly one too. I forget the name of it. There was the Bleacher Creature with the Yankees. That was long forgotten for good reason. Blooper and Rhubarb with the White Sox. Those were some really awful Sid Marty Krofft type mascots from the early 80s. So, you know, if there was a mascot that terrified your dreams as a child, you can blame Ted Gianulis and the San Diego Chicken. Now, beyond the baseball field, like I said, the chicken became one of the biggest marketing gigs ever. It was rebranded the Famous Chicken in 1979. If you grew up in the early 1980s like I did, you remember the Baseball Bunch with Johnny Bench and Tommy Lasorda, and Ozzie Smith was a guest on there. Well, the Famous Chicken was a big part of that. And, the Famous Chicken would go on for many, many years. And what's funny is sometimes the Famous Chicken became the draw to an event. Going to college in Alabama, I used to make the drive to Birmingham for Birmingham Bulls hockey games. So they were in the East Coast Hockey League. And I remember looking in the media guide, they listed the top 10 attendance figures. And the Bulls played in a big 1970s multi-purposed arena. It was a 16,000-seat arena called the Birmingham Jefferson Civic Center, and it's still in operation these days. But, it's Tier 2 hockey in Birmingham, Alabama in the 1990s. You only drew typically maybe 800 or 900 people to a game. Well, the games that drew 13,000, 14,000 people, I think it was like 7 of the top 10 most attended games in Birmingham Bulls history had the Famous Chicken as a guest there. So I don't know what that says more about the chicken or the fine people of Birmingham, Alabama, but take that for what it's worth. Now, Gianulis has been stepping aside from playing the Famous Chicken. However, he has certainly turned that into quite the career. And it all started again as fate would have it. He just happened to walk by the student radio station at the right time, at the exact same time that the local representative from KGB Radio is there. And the rest, as they say, is history. Much like this podcast, it is history as we wrap up the not so super or valuable look at a super value Donruss grab bag featuring repackaged garbage cards from the 1982 Donruss set, a plethora of Ed Lynch cards, a San Diego Chicken as well, and again, 18 packs of Action All-Stars, which if you'd like them, just DM me at Wax and Gum Stains. Name your price. First come, first serve. I will ship them to you, and I will let you share in the joy that is the Super Value Pack Action All-Star Edition. Again, they're 1985 Action All-Star cards, if you were wondering. So we appreciate your listening to this podcast. And again, I appreciate Andy, agreeing to join me in the next program. So again, make sure you tune in on Friday, August the 2nd, as we will talk about baseball card backs, sports card backs, some of the uniqueness of card backs, and how did Andy get into it? Why the backs of cards instead of the front of cards? It's actually some very interesting stuff that we will discuss. And like I said, we'll probably open up some vintage pack or two to go along with that. Share some stories of the baseball players that we find in these packs as well. And I will be attending the local card show this weekend. So who knows what bargain bin beauty or other notable cards I find. It's been a couple months since I've been to one of the shows, so I'm looking forward to it as I can restock on some of the cards that we take a peek at here on Wax Ecstatic. And one more cheap plug, if you would like to donate to Wax Ecstatic, keep the program going, keep the cards coming, keep the discussion carrying on for a long time, you can do so at paypal.me/waxecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thanks so much for tuning in. I hope this wasn't forced fun for you. It's real, legitimate fun. And if it wasn't, I'll see you at Dave & Buster's Tuesday morning at 11. I think we have an all-staff meeting. I'll see you then.